opening is, oh gosh, I'm not going to try to pronounce it, Muda Hinuka versus Holder, case number 093255. Mr. Giglio.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Bradley Giglio, on behalf of the respondent, Muda Hinuka.
What do you say his name?
It's Jean-Marie Vianney Muda Hinuka.
Sean.
It's pronounced just like it's spelled.
Your Honors, if the law provides for the availability of a remedy, in this case, deferral of removal or withholding of removal, the alien or respondent must have the ability to exercise it. In this case, specifically with the withholding of removal, demonstrating that my client faced persecution, or deferral of removal indicating that my client faced torture upon removal to Rwanda, my client never had the opportunity to present that case, specifically based on the due process violations and the legal errors committed with regard to the expert witness that he presented before the immigration judge. Specifically, the immigration court curtailed the attorney's questioning repeatedly throughout the record. It's blatant over more than a dozen pages of the transcript, and even specifically on the administrative record 825, the attorney is trying to say, can I ask him just, and he's cut off by the court at that time. Again, on page 829, my client's trial counsel says, quote, okay, he's consulted, end quote, and is cut off by the court again, trying to bring out the qualifications of this expert. Those are just two examples of several pages worth of curtailing of the questions of this expert. And the rule here is that my client didn't have the opportunity to present this evidence. His efforts were frustrated by the court and by the impact upon his due process rights. Specifically, or that frustration of his ability to bring this evidence into court is evident even in the attorney's trial counsel's own words before the court. If you look at page 835 of the administrative record, the respondent's own counsel says, quote, Judge, if I can just not be stopped while I'm asking my questions. I've been through this at least every other questions I've been asking, end quote. If that doesn't show and demonstrate the frustration that respondent's counsel had in trying to present evidence that this not only was this witness an expert, but that my client faced persecution and faced torture upon removal, I'm not sure what would show it. You have time and time again where the attorney is unable to bring out those qualifications, unable to bring out what the persecution would be, what the torture would be, and specifically what the qualifications of this expert are.
How does this argument fit within the scope of our review on this claim?
Your Honor, we're raising constitutional issues based on Your Honor's questions regarding jurisdiction. Specifically, my client's due process rights were violated, and also the legal errors committed by the court. Specifically, his inability to exercise a specific remedy at law. The court precluded him or prohibited him from exercising this withholding of removal and deferral of removal by presenting the evidence. We're not here arguing that the immigration judge got it wrong and that withholding should have been granted or that deferment should have been granted. That I think would need to be redecided upon remand and my client actually able to present the evidence that the immigration judge needed to hear in the first place to make that decision, and that wasn't even allowed. So besides the curtailing of the question, the immigration judge applied the wrong standard in assessing whether or not this expert, this witness, was in fact an expert or not.
Well, what did was he not able to get in? I guess he was being interrupted. Was it because he was being redundant, or was it because it was, well, what are you saying? He was just being interrupted.
The court
say how he's going to be tortured or persecuted or whatever.
The immigration judge asked more questions than my client's attorney did of this expert to show you how invasive the court's questioning was. Not to say that the immigration judge didn't have the authority to ask questions. Clearly, it does. However, the efforts of the attorney were clearly frustrated. He was not able to bring out the evidence that he was trying to get out. It's noticeable through the transcript, pages and pages of interruptions by the immigration judge at the time. And then there's like three or four questions about almost like, if I can just squeeze these questions in about torture of my client. What percentage of torture did he face? Would he face torture? The attorney's efforts are clearly frustrated. I mean, I think it's evident from his own language in the transcript that he's like, Judge, I'm trying to get this evidence in. I'm trying to demonstrate that this witness is an expert. You know, he's taught at Harvard. He personally observed the genocide in Rwanda. He was in constant contact with members of the Human Rights Watch. He even named one of them by name to show that he had contact with someone on the ground in Rwanda, even though he wasn't physically there, which leads into the improper expert rule that was applied. I mean, Daubert doesn't apply. The spirit of Daubert applies. But the immigration judge went further to apply even a more strict standard than Daubert, specifically requiring that this expert have published in that area. And the case law is clear that it does not require experts don't have to publish in that area. But beyond that, he was requiring this expert to have firsthand knowledge of the data of which he was going to opine. As if you bring an expert into court and there's a car accident, and unless the expert observed the car accident occur or observed the dents physically, him or herself, they can't opine about it. If in this case, this expert hadn't been in Rwanda since 2003, and because of that, and because he hadn't published in the area, he couldn't opine about it, even though he was working on a master's thesis. He had taught on this at Harvard. He had people personally that collecting data for him on the ground, and that wasn't sufficient. It was requiring him to have physical, firsthand knowledge of the data of which he was going to opine, and that's stricter than Daubert. It's in the opposite direction. And so by imposing this stricter standard, the judge improperly applied the law. I think it's noteworthy, too, that for the government, they admitted Human Rights Watch documents against my client, but the expert couldn't use firsthand knowledge from Human Rights Watch workers to enter an opinion before this court. That's clearly inconsistent. But beyond the due process violations with regard to this expert witness, there was also, with regard to the withholding of removal with my client having to demonstrate that he faced persecution, the immigration judge on 339 of the record gives a one-sentence dismissal of that argument, saying the respondent evidence falls short that he faces a more likely than not chance of persecution, and then explains his reasoning in the Convention Against Torture section, which is, again, the immigration judge applying the wrong burden, the wrong standard. Torture is different from persecution. The case law is clear about that. And in this case, the judge on 339 gives a one sentence saying that my client didn't meet his burden in terms of demonstrating that he faced persecution. And then he says, I'll explain why infra in the Convention Against Torture section, and then uses the Convention Against Torture standard in evaluating the claim. So, again, illegal error. That's why jurisdiction resides with this court. This isn't to say that the evidence was so strong for my client that he should have been granted withholding removal or deferral of removal, but that he wasn't even given the chance to present the evidence that he had. I mean, there's evidence in the record about the persecution that exists even today. The expert witness talked about how even attorneys face persecution by defending people charged with genocide or defending people who claim that they weren't involved in genocide. And, you know, even this past Monday, a Chicago attorney, Peter Erlander in Rwanda, was just arrested for that very thing. Just as an aside, I think this expert witness was right on track.
To the extent that you're arguing that the immigration judge applied the persecution standard instead of the Convention Against Torture standard,
vice versa, yes. I'm saying that that on page 339 of the record, he dismisses that the evidence, or basically says my client didn't prove that he's more likely than not to face persecution upon removal to Rwanda.
But that's a lower standard. So if he applied, it redounded to your client's benefit if he applied a lower standard, is my point.
I don't think that it's lower. I think that it's distinct. It's differently applied. Because when you Withholding of removal requires a showing that the harm feared would be inflicted based on statutorily protected grounds with regard to persecution. And conventions against torture don't require that basis.
What is it? The cat, isn't that where you've got to show it's more probable than not that it's going to be tortured? I mean, it's pretty high, isn't it?
That is the correct standard. However, my client had testified about his family having been burned alive or poisoned to death or otherwise killed, multiple family members. And I think there was also evidence of that as well in the record.
Of course, the torture and all this has to be government-inspired, at least, if not executed.
Well, and the expert in the immigration judge proceedings talked about how the government wants some cases, for instance, the example was political defendants over there, to be found guilty. Some that, and he stated that some that were found not guilty remained in jail, and that the ones that the government wanted to be found guilty were either found guilty or that people were scared to represent them because they themselves might be persecuted, either witnesses to testify saying this person didn't participate in genocide or attorneys to stand up and say, you know, I represent this person, he's my client. He didn't engage in genocide.
Well, that reminds me of a curiosity that I had where they're talking about the quality of the prison that you put in. It seemed that were some certain people who maybe you would call were targeted got to be in a, we'll call it a better prison.
Well, there is testimony in the record about how the based on the indictment that he was would be placed in a specific jail in Rwanda. But then there was testimony from the expert indicating that once someone enters one jail, they don't necessarily stay there. I believe the expert's testimony on that or the purported expert was not flushed out fully. But that is an issue.
A singling out issue as opposed to quality. I thought that's maybe what you were after.
Well, I think that is an issue, absolutely. As far as who has control over the prison, does the government have the control? Is the government targeting him directly? I mean, if the government indicted him, he would potentially face persecution if they see him as a political prisoner or as a political criminal. I mean, this case has the government saying that my client committed unspeakable acts of genocide. It has my client talking about how he was the victim of unspeakable acts of genocide. They're starkly different. But either way, you have to get it right, and my client has to have a right to present evidence to demonstrate that. He has the right to take advantage of these remedies, and when he can't take advantage of the remedies, that gives this court the jurisdiction to say, do it over, and give him an opportunity to present the evidence to demonstrate his case. He came here as a refugee. He was granted asylum. At the very least, that the law requires and demands that he, under Sokolov case, that this court's case from 2006, that he has the right to take advantage of the remedies that are available. If he's not given that opportunity, then there's an error that was committed by that court, clear as day. With regard to the particularly serious finding by the immigration judge, it is discretionary. I know but in applying that discretion, the courts have specifically outlined factors that must be considered. Some of them are conviction records, sentencing information, and the underlying facts and circumstances of the conviction. In this case, the judge used the 51-month sentence against my client and improperly applied that factor to him in making this the determination that it was a particularly serious crime.
Well, he found that he lied about whether he struggled with the fought with the agents when he was arrested.
That was another factor as well, correct?
Yeah.
However,
that was a very important factor, I thought.
I think in considering all the facts, having been in this country for a couple years, not committing any violations of the law here, and having at 4 or 5 in the morning, armed agents storm into my bedroom where I have my wife and children, I would probably be startled as well. Certainly, fighting with an agent is not something that should be condoned. However,
but he denied fighting with
him. He denied using an armed weapon against the agent. In fact, it was the agent's shotgun coming in to the bedroom and The testimony at this point varies depending on who's talking as far as whether the door was pushed against the agent, whether my client grabbed the shotgun and was pushing back or was trying to take it. That's inconsistent across multiple transcripts. But even though there are points that may point that it is particularly serious, the court has an obligation to apply all the factors and to apply them correctly, and they didn't apply them correctly here.
Well, no, it's
the aggregate sentence.
An entirely discretionary decision, which we don't review.
Well,
and so, you know, whether this crime qualifies or doesn't qualify is completely up to the agency.
But it's not up to the agency to choose not to apply the factors outlined in matter of NAM, for instance, incorrectly. That 51-month aggregate
how
sentence.
How is that different than saying the agency abused its discretion? It's the same thing. You're just using different words to try to fit it within the scope of our review.
Well, I think if he's sentenced for four counts and 51 months for all four, and three of them have nothing to do with why they determined it to be a particularly serious crime, the court needs to factor that in, and they didn't. Thank you.
Mr. McManus.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. And may it please the Court, Keith McManus on behalf of the respondent, the Attorney General of the United States. Your Honor, despite counsel's classification or characterization of the agency's decision, the critical question in this case is whether the court actually has jurisdiction to review any of the dispositive determinations made by the agency. And because Mr. Mudanyaka has never denied that he is removable for having been convicted of multiple aggravated felony offenses, the court generally lacks jurisdiction, except to the extent that he raises legitimate, colorable constitutional claims or pure questions of law. And the only claims he does raise in his petition are neither legal nor constitutional or are otherwise meritless. With regard to the particularly serious crime determination, first I think it's important to remember that there are two independently dispositive determinations that govern his applications for withholding under the INA and the CAT. He is statutorily barred from that relief and protection if his crime is particularly serious and, as the agency found in this case, if he assisted or participated in persecution. And because the agency relied on both of those reasons for denying his applications, the court can uphold the decision on either ground. But with regard to the court's limited jurisdiction, the particularly serious crime determination, as Judge Sykes just pointed out, is inherently discretionary and therefore unreviewable. Although there are per se categories of aggravated felony crimes that would be considered particularly serious under the statute, here Mr. Mudanyaka's crimes do not fall within that category, but nevertheless, the agency properly relied on particular factors such as the nature of the crime, the facts and circumstances underlying the convictions, and the aggregate criminal sentence in determining that his assault conviction was in fact particularly serious. And the weighing of those factors, or the way in which the agency considered and interpreted those factors, is purely discretionary and therefore unreviewable. So that determination in and of itself disposes of Mr. Mudanyaka's applications under the INA and CAT with regard to withholding. And as if that weren't enough, the agency went on to conclude that he's also statutorily barred because he assisted or participated in persecution. Now, that factual determination, whether he actually assisted or participated, is also unreviewable under the statute because, again, A2C, subsection A2C, bars review of those factual and discretionary determinations. And the only way the court can review those findings is if the agency erred as a matter of law or violated the Constitution in some way. Again, the claims he raises on review do not fall within that category because with regard to the persecutor bar finding, he argues only that the agency erred in relying on certain witness testimony, that being, I think it was hearsay statements from witnesses in the United States, upon which the federal government relied in criminally prosecuting him here in the United States. Well, that inference cannot be borne out by the record, Your Honor, because the IJ and the board made clear that they were relying on statements from witnesses in Rwanda, which were used as a basis for the Rwandan government's indictment and international arrest warrant. I mean, a clear, plain reading of the agency decisions makes that pretty obvious. And so even to the extent that the court thinks that Mr. Mudanyaka's claim falls within the pure question of law category, it's fatally flawed for that reason. And even if it weren't, substantial evidence clearly supports the agency's decision that he did assist or participate in persecution. And Mr. Mudaniaka has never argued that the record compels a contrary conclusion. It's important to note, Your Honor, that it's no coincidence that there are a number of independent sources naming Mr. Mudaniaka as a participant in the genocide, not the least of which is the indictment and arrest warrant issued by the government Rwanda, or the statements by the witnesses in Rwanda that gave rise to those proceedings. In addition, there are various scholarly articles that again, identify him by name as a leader of the Interahamwe who was intimately involved with the mass killings. There are additional articles that refer to a chief militant known as Zuzu, a name by which Mr. Mudaniaka admits he was known in Rwanda and the United States. So there's a mountain of evidence to support the agency's factual determination that he did, in fact, assist or participate, and he points to no compellingly contrary evidence in the record. But again, that's assuming, Your Honor, that the court could even reach that factual determination, which it cannot, because he does not raise a valid legal or constitutional argument with respect to that determination. So both of those independent findings by the agency are sufficient to dispose of Mr. Mudaniaka's claims with regard to withholding. And that leaves only the application for deferral of removal under the Convention Against Torture. And I think it's in that...
Was that the main focus of the expert witness?
That's right, Your Honor, and I think that's important to narrow the focus of counsel's due process and constitutional claims, because he suggests that somehow the immigration judge's treatment and examination of that particular witness, who I might point out he inappropriately refers to as a expert, both the immigration judge and the board declined to recognize that witness as an expert. But notwithstanding that fact, the focus of the inquiry there was whether or not Mr. Mudaniaka would be subject to torture, which is only relevant to his CAT deferral application. And even assuming, again, that he does raise a valid due process or legal argument with respect to the immigration judge's conduct, his claims are meritless. And that's because the immigration judge is afforded authority by statute to examine, interrogate, and cross-examine the alien or any witness. And in this case, you know, despite his reference to certain individual exchanges or lines from the immigration judge's hearing, there is no evidence that the immigration judge was in any way biased against Mr. Mudaniaka or that he somehow deprived him of what he's afforded by statute, which is only a reasonable and fair opportunity to be heard and to present evidence on his behalf. And the court need look no further than the record, which proves that despite the immigration judge's interjections or his repeated interruptions of the testimony, the witness was allowed to continue to testify. And Mr. Mudaniaka's attorney was able to directly examine him extensively. And that evidence was submitted in the record. All the immigration judge and the board determined was that he was not actually an expert, and therefore that his testimony was not persuasive. Jumping ahead, there's no indication of prejudice, even again assuming that the immigration judge somehow overstepped his bounds or erred in his examination of that particular witness. Mr. Mudaniaka would have to demonstrate prejudice in order to be successful in his due process claim. And I forget which of Your Honors asked the question, but he does not identify what information in particular his witness was precluded from offering. He repeatedly suggests that he was cut off and that he was not allowed to testify, but he doesn't explain what evidence he would have put on that would have changed the outcome in the case. And therefore, that failure to demonstrate any prejudice is basically fatal to his due process claim.
Well, the curiosity that I would have is with regard to the prison and people who are ahead of him in line for whatever trial they're going to get and that sort of thing. Somewhere it's emphasized there's no death penalty. But the people who participated in this butchering of lots of people, very vicious. I don't know at what level it happens. It seemed that it was unfortunately down to almost neighbors against neighbors. Whoever orchestrated it at the top. What happens to those people? I mean, do they imprison and everything? There has to be just a huge undertow of resentment, hate. I just wondered if some expert can give some testimony as to what actually has been happening.
Well, I think, Your Honor, the record does is actually replete with evidence from a recognized government expert, Dr. Shabas, or Professor Shabas, who indicated that despite Mr. Muhudanyaka's claims to the contrary, he would, in fact, be entitled to a fair trial in Rwanda if that were to come to pass, and that, again, despite his claims to the contrary, the record evidence suggests that prison conditions in Rwanda are, in fact, improving. And because he would actually, if this is all speculative, but if he were tried, convicted, and sentenced, he would actually be imprisoned at a particular, more modern and apparently sufficient prison that Dr. Shabas, or Professor Shabas, testified was within the standards, the internationally recognized standards. And so there's no indication from this record to support Mr. Muhudanyaka's claims that even if he is tried and convicted, that he would be subjected to persecution or torture if imprisoned in Rwanda. But it's important to remember, Your Honor, that just because of the jurisdictional bar in this case, this court can't reweigh that evidence and determine whether or not there is any likelihood of torture based on the record. It's Mr. Muhunyaka's claims in particular that must be considered to determine whether or not they fall within the exception for a legal or constitutional claim. And because they do not, the court can't go beyond and delve into the record to determine, as Judge Sykes suggested, whether the immigration judge or the board got it right on the facts. Those determinations remain unreviewable by virtue of his aggravated felony convictions. And that's
mostly just curious whether under those, and some expert, somebody would know what's going on and how they're treated and whether there are repercussions.
Well, if there was someone more qualified, Your Honor, than Professor Shabas, that expert was not presented in this case. But that doesn't diminish the government's case against Mr. Muhunyaka, and it certainly doesn't increase the persuasiveness of his purported expert's testimony. All the immigration judge and the board had to go on here was a litany of background evidence regarding conditions in Rwanda and the testimony of these two witnesses, one a well-recognized expert and one who both the immigration judge and the board determined was not an expert in this particular case. But based on that,
he had no particular expertise in the Rwandan justice system or prisons or jails, etc.
The finding was based on the fact, I mean, he was only a doctoral candidate at the time, so he had not even achieved his PhD, which is, again, not to diminish his extensive education. But the immigration judge ultimately determined that, as is in the spirit of Daubert, that his testimony was neither reliable or relevant. And mostly it's based on reliability because the witness's testimony was based almost exclusively on secondhand knowledge. And he admitted that he had neither toured a Rwandan prison or observed judicial proceedings there for quite some time, and that he was only being updated with information from other researchers in Rwanda. And ultimately, the immigration judge pitted that testimony against that of Professor Shabas and determined that it was not persuasive. But again, this case is important to recognize that it's different from cases where the immigration judge or the board exclude outright testimony from a witness who is either not recognized as an expert or whose testimony is otherwise deemed irrelevant. Here, Mr. Twagumargu's, forgive me if I mispronounce that, the witness's testimony was included in the record and considered against the other record evidence weighing against Mr. Muhudanyaka. And in any event, Your Honor, again, the court cannot second-guess the agency's weighing of that evidence in this case. It's critical to start from the premise that because Mr. Muhudanyaka does not deny that he is removable as an aggravated felon, the court's jurisdiction is strictly limited in this case. And again, the only claims he raises either do not fall within the legal or constitutional exception or are otherwise meritless. With the little time I have left, Your Honor, I just wanted to make sure I addressed a couple of specific claims. One was Mr. Mudanyaka's counsel made a point to cite the immigration judge's decision where he talked about denying the withholding of removal claim on the merits, notwithstanding the mandatory denials and the statutory bars. I think it's important to recall that the board did not affirm that determination. The board's decision, which is the final agency decision in this case, rests solely on the mandatory denials, that being the particularly serious crime determination and the persecutor bar. So to the extent that that decision demonstrates any error on the part of the immigration judge, it's not relevant here because the board did not affirm it. But there is no error because, as I think Judge Sykes, again, you pointed this out, the standards for both withholding and CAT are the same in the sense that an alien must demonstrate that it's more likely than not. The distinction comes between whether or not he'll be tortured on account of persecuted on account of a protected ground or tortured. And the immigration judge's decision does not demonstrate that he was he was not relying on an erroneous standard, only that for the same reasons Mr. Mudanyaka did not prove that he would be tortured, he also failed to prove that it's more likely than not that he'd be persecuted. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Giglio, how much time? 3.5 minutes.
With respect to the curtailing of the individual who was presented as an expert, although it wasn't found to be an expert by the immigration judge, on 829 of the record, the judge specifically says, quote, I'm not going to have him testify as an expert because someone has told him something that they did. That refers specifically to that same individual, that same witness's testimony from 827, which talks about the contact that he has with Rwanda, that he left himself in 2003 because he was persecuted. He testified about all of his knowledge about the jails in Rwanda up until that point and said that he was in constant contact with multiple individuals in Rwanda since then and, like I said, taught at Harvard and also other institutions and continued his education specifically on the genocide in Rwanda. And he's demonstrating that he had firsthand knowledge of through his contacts in Rwanda of what was going on. And the judge specifically said that essentially an expert can only testify to what they observed themselves, which is not Daubert. And that's stricter than Daubert, and Daubert doesn't even apply here. So clearly the standard that was imposed was stricter than what is imposed in non-immigration courts, and it was improper. That's clear as day, the burden that was imposed on that witness to demonstrate his expertise.
Are there Rwanda cases that you're aware of where someone has been granted withholding or CAT?
I do not have those with me today.
Well, I'm not saying with you. I just wondered in your own research if there have been before this where somebody did come up with the right evidence where they did get withholding of removal. Or
I don't know the answer to that.
You don't know of any?
Not personally.
No personally or record, anything?
I'm not aware. I could present those subsequently in a subsequent
no,
brief.
I'm curious if you've run across them in the process of this case.
I haven't specifically targeted them. I have not come across them.
All right.
With regard to the whether or not the BIA considered the witness testimony, I know counsel and I have gone back and forth about whether or not the record shows that. And what I'm specifically looking at is page 5 of the BIA opinion. And the bottom it says, I'll quote the opinion, the applicant's assertion that he was not associated in any way with the killings are not believable in light of the background evidence and the witness's statements. Now, that witness's statements is generic. It doesn't specify which witness's statements that the judge, that the BIA was considering when they rendered this opinion. The most recent witnesses mentioned in the BIA opinion is the previous paragraph, which specifically names two witnesses, a Dr. Josue, J-O-S-U-E, and a Ruhamya Charles. Now, those two witnesses are never in, they're not in the Rwanda affidavits that counsel says that the BIA is referring to. So those specific witnesses that the BIA talks about in the paragraph right before it says, based on those witnesses' statements, the applicant's assertions are not believable, those witnesses are not in the Rwanda affidavits. So I'm not sure how you can come to that conclusion. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement. And our